anyone have a question or anything to say from the retreat so far?
In some traditions, there's prayer, and we're putting that, the belief or a set of ideas on something, and we're asking it to give us something back. And at other times, I've heard you speak of help that comes. And there's lots of traditions like Hinduism and Tibetan Buddhism, and a whole pantheon of traditions that pray to energies, to being. And in some ways it seems quite contradictive to teachings like Advaita and some of the Buddhist teachings. And I guess that holds a point of confusion.
One nice way to think about it partly comes again from the Yoga Sutras that I mentioned yesterday that you know also, the very, very, very simple, deep lines about yoga, meaning union, as most people know now. But if we just think of the loving kindness meditation that we just did, and the possibility of letting our deepest wish for this life, letting that spread out as far as we can imagine and even more, and playing with letting that, so let's say the presence of peace or joy or lightness or clarity, freedom, letting some deep heart in us wish that for ourselves, wish that for these people, wish that sometimes it might be weird and sometimes not. Maybe it's a lot easier trees than people, grass, and then people that we would see as completely undeserving of any kindness. What is it like to offer anyway, or to let that wish? What else could we wish in the face of cruelty? May there be peace. And then even just letting that, the movement of that wish, may there be peace. For example, any other wish is also fine. Deep wish. Even when there's not a person or a creature to wish it for. So beyond imagination. Sometimes we can get the sense of just letting that fullness of the wish take all the place that we have, and a little more. And it's a moment when, if that happens, it doesn't always happen, but if it does happen kind of genuinely, sometimes we get a flash of, is this me letting my mind be fully infused with this goodness? Or is it also really sending out any good vibration to the world? And then, like, is there actually a difference between my mind and the world? So the possibility of kind of reaching out, even if I'm wishing goodness instead of asking for help, asking for goodness. In the Yoga Sutras, they talk about, okay, if you want to pray, if you want to have a god, so pick a god, any god, and pray to that god. And focus so much on that god that there starts to be nothing left but that god, or that you are that, and then even that falls apart. So there's actually the poem that I brought in today is kind of speaks to that too. Also, maybe just to say before I read the poem, it's Rumi, Coleman Barks, so Coleman Barks does Rumi. Never know how much is Rumi, how much is Coleman Barks. But I like the poem anyway. Even if we don't know why help happens, if we can kind of check in our experience that sometimes we've been more receptive and help has happened. So we've been more receptive because we were tender, or we've been more receptive because we were desperate, or we were just in place, like things in their place, no demand. And there was a different kind of sensitivity. It's like our human sensitivity gets filled up instead of being all wiry and raw and nervy and anxious. So this piece is called Water from Your Spring. And I'll just read the whole thing for fun, and then we might come back to bits of it during the rest of the talk. And this is from a tradition where there is help from another, there is another person who helps. What was in that candle's light that opened and consumed me so quickly? Come back, my friend. The form of our love is not a created form. Nothing can help me but that beauty. There was a dawn I remember when my soul heard something from your soul. I drank water from your spring and felt the current take me. Shall I read it again? Water from your spring. What was in that candle's light that opened and consumed me so quickly? Come back, my friend. The form of our love is not a created form. Nothing can help me but that beauty. There was a dawn, I remember, when my soul heard something from your soul. I drank water from your spring and felt the current take me. What I want from this poem, especially, is the line, the form of our love is not a created form. And when Kelly is speaking about help and people finding ways to connect to energies or something that we can't see but we can kind of feel, something that's doesn't yet have a created form, it's not about the created form. So we have, let's say, contact with help. We feel love. And there's an experience of love. There's an experience of joy. There's an experience of being uplifted beyond what our effort could do. And that experience is important, but it's some kind of quality in the experience that he's calling beauty. That beauty, nothing but that beauty can save me, I think he said. Nothing can help me but that beauty. He's not being too overdramatic. The form of our love is not a created form. So there is some kind of almost substance, an insubstantial substance of our love, where there is that kind of connection. It's not a created form. So any of the experiences that we have together in help aren't it. But the beauty that happens there is what can help us, nothing else. I also love a line that I don't have exactly here, and I wanted to bring it to the talk, and it also speaks to what you're kind of questioning. It's an interaction between Ramana Maharshi, who is one of my teachers, though I never met him, and someone who asked him about helping the world, and whether doing so-called inner work does anything to help the world. So this is continuing also from our other conversation. And this is where I wish I had Ramana's like really simple, dry, I think humorous answer. It was something like, yes, if there's any difference between helping the world and helping yourself, between going in and going out. So if we want to go out to go in, we can go out to go in. If we want to go in to go out, we can go in to go out. It comes around. Either way, they say that it's important when it comes around. It can be an important moment when I've been praying to some particular face of God, let's say, some particular way of connecting, something that has inspired me. And then I am that. There's a way that I experience that. That is what I am. And that's good for a while. And then letting go of that as yet another thing that's not the form of our love. And it could be similarly going in if we're like against gods and images and going out, and we're pro going in. We're going to come around and find ourselves out. So if we can let go of what we thought was in when we find out that it's not anymore possible to say. Who lives where? So we talked yesterday about perfection and non-perfection and the possibility of not worrying about either one. The possibility that even actual imperfections that we have don't get in the way of our perfection. And that there is a way that we could kind of tame or soften the imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, in the words of the Buddha. We can work on that. And we don't need to work on our perfection that already is perfect. And we talked about the first and the kind of primary so-called imperfection of mind that weakens wisdom, as the feeling that there's something wrong with me, the feeling that I'm not enough or that life's not enough. We can call it lack or we can call it greed. And the possibility of not being moved by that. So let it come. Let it be its own imperfect self and let it not move us. Let us connect with that or those resources that are freely available, that are enough to support us and our family. So this is what we spoke of yesterday. So there is kind of work to be done, and there is work to stop doing. To stop doing the work of trying to be perfect, because we already are. There is that perfect true nature, possibly, that's what they say. And there are those imperfections that we do experience and that are painful. And when we are moved by them, when we're moved by the thought that I'm not good enough or the world is too terrible a place to live in or whatever, when I'm moved by that, then it is as if I am that. It is as if I take that shape. So it's not my true shape, but it looks like it is. It almost might as well be, but luckily it's not. So in the Buddha's metaphor about debt, it's we live as if we're in debt, even though we have resources, borrowing from outside. And then we might as well be in debt. Except that we're not. So in the kind of quest to find out what is actually tameable, what we can actually tame, that kind of destructive wildness that happens in the mind, you're really not good enough. Everyone else is, but you're not. Or everyone else is something, but you're really, it's your those specially difficult circumstances that you have that no one else has ever had. Some way that we're specially off mark. And if we can give up being special and just be ordinary, so in the whole story of the clover of Stonehouse, but I just realized we haven't talked about it on this retreat yet. So I gave a whole talk about it on the weekend. Here, there's magical clover, and every year I find lots of three-leaf clovers and also lots of four and five and six and seven-leaf clovers. And so today I'm in the mood of really loving the three-leaf clovers, and there's so many of them, and they're just so full of rain. So giving up the kind of, maybe I'm going to find that special eight-leaf clover or whatever, and it'll be a sign. That's the kind of way of being in debt, where we need the four-leaf clover to confirm something that doesn't need confirmation. And practicing the fact that it doesn't need confirmation, the already enoughness, can help us love all those three-leaf clovers just as much. So in this movement, like kind of shift towards our depth, where we stop believing and experiencing that we are in debt, and we start finding how many resources we have, even when we feel empty. There's a kind of movement through various kinds of knowing. And in the Sanskrit texts, they talk about three kinds of knowing. Not as the only three, but three kinds of knowing as one kind of trail. And the first kind is just like curiosity, where we think, oh, maybe I'll find a four-leaf clover, or I wonder if it's going to rain. Why does it rain after all? I think I learned it in school, but I can't remember. We don't really care about the answer, and we'll forget in a few minutes that we had the question. It's not a bad thing, but we could say it has a kind of immaturity to it. When we kind of reap the sense of wonder that might be in that kind of curious questioning, and leave out the kind of busyness of all the questions. What's that? What's that? What does it mean? Where does it come from? But the sense of wonder and awe stays. Then we can kind of drop into what we could call really hard to describe. If we have the sense of wonder, and it's like it wants to have a direction, it has a lot of power in it. It wants to point somewhere. But it's like with the uncreated form. The form of our love is not a created form. It's like looking towards created forms, trying to find that beauty. And kind of knowing it's not really the form itself, exactly. It's not the form itself, but it's not just that four-leaf clover or three-leaf clover. And so there's this strong direction, wonder with direction, that's at the same time kind of directionless or going in all directions at the same time. So just with the simple, if we come back to the simple experience of wonder, amazement, or awe, there can be that one thing that strikes us, and then it really opens out wider than even ourselves. So that's one example of what I'm trying to describe. And that opening out, it leaves us open, leaves us receptive to help. And it leaves us receptive to help of our own and from wherever, whatever helps. So we're more receptive to our own deep inclination. And we're more receptive to the simple ways that other people help us, whether they are visible now or invisible, like their legacy. Does that make any sense? And are there questions so far? Doesn't quite look like a question, but...
An atmosphere of confusion.
Confusion can be good. Confusion falls in the category here of the second kind of knowing. So wonder, awe, confusion. What does confusion mean? Sometimes it means I thought I knew where I was going, and now I realize I don't even know where I am. That's sometimes what confusion is. And to realize I don't know where I am is a good start. It's much better than thinking I know where I'm going when I actually don't know where I am. So it's kind of an unpeeling of a false knowing or an old knowing, which was usually convenient, helpful to get through, or delusional, complete imagination. So it's like an unveiling of some kind of innate power, that the more we get out of its way, the more it knows where it's going, and we find out afterwards. And when we try to drive it is when we go in one direction, all directions, no direction. But often it will be that there is something, either in my inner experience or something that I see or hear or taste, smell, etc. that manages to touch me. So it gets through all my protection and touches me. And I might not want to be touched. I might not want to be touched that deeply. I might want to not be touched right now. I might not want to be touched there. Where we're touched is in a place that is much, it helps us feel how we're much bigger than the usual frame. Some of you from previous years know about Gemma's, who taught here the first 3 years, her pull towards horses. And she wasn't one of those girls who grew up around horses and rode horses and ate horses and drank horses and breathed horses. It just started coming in to her life. And so if I see a horse book, I usually buy it for her. Even when it's a ridiculous place to buy a book, like an airport. And it was an airport in Delhi, which I think it's the first time I bought anything in the airport in Delhi. And even more reason not to buy it, it was one of those little books with like watercolors and quotations about horses. But I read some of them and they were good. I liked it. They struck home. Some of them struck home in a terrible way, and one of them that I'm about to say is one of those. It talked about the horses that are called wild horses that are in still North America. They still manage to hang on. And how people would sometimes see them and be touched. They would be touched by that wildness with a kind of calmness, but not like calm putting out the flame kind of calmness. And so then people would go and try to catch the horses to have them. Which, when we say it, it sounds silly, but every day this happens, not just with horses. We will so often be touched by something that's wild and spirited and calm, but not put out, not extinguished. And then we want to go get it and have it. The terrible thing is that it's a horse in this case. It's actually a living being. And to try to get the horse often meant that in the process, the horses would die. So in the process of trying to get the horse because you liked its wildness, you lose the horse. This is, I think, what happens. I think it's worth, even though it's a terrible image, and even though it's true, I hesitate to bring it into the retreat. I think it shows us how when we have that powerful being touched, and we want to respond in some way, how powerfully we need to kind of be held back from doing the killing way of trying to tame the wrong thing. What we need to tame is the feeling of lack, that I've got to get it and have it, not that wildness and that spiritedness and that calmness that's not extinguished. Sometimes it happens that we try to meditate and every once in a while something happens in the meditation that seems like it might be meditation or closer. And it touches us inside so deeply. Even though we don't yet know how we've been touched, what we've been touched by, where it might lead. If we can kind of keep in mind that when we're touched, it's the wildness, touching the wildness, the spiritedness touching the spiritedness. And to wait and be more clear about what needs taming for us to live in connection or communion with that spiritedness. It's amazing how this so much echoes the question about paths that are outer focused, and then how that is basically similar to paths that are inner focused. On the way there, we're so likely to use too much force on the wrong thing. So we have something wonderful happens and we're not even sure if we did it. We know that we didn't do the whole thing. It happened. And there can be a powerful response of wanting to have it and keep it. And we make promises to ourselves that we know we're not going to keep, about how we're just going to stay on retreat forever. Or And if we can kind of hang steady with all of that power, powerfully touched by something that's untamable and powerful, so that we can kind of feel that it is outside and inside us. It is home and foreign. It's unknown and known. And that starts to unveil this different kind of knowing. And so we fall into the third kind of knowing. Which is when it's not, when I give up trying to know about. So I give up trying to have the created form. And I let the pull in to being that. Being in that, we could say, like, the form of our love is not a created form. Being that form of our love that's not a created form. In this poem, Verses on Faith Mind, Seng San talks about this letting go of wanting to know about, wanting to have information about the created form. So however subtle the created form is, that experience in meditation is a subtle form. It's already happened. Verses on Faith Mind, the song about trust, the possibility of trust that lies in us, in our deeper mind, or our deeper heart. To trust that whatever went into that wonderful experience rides along with us into the next created form, the next created form, the next created form, but it, the form of it is uncreated. And when we like that ride, when we like to ride along with trust in that uncreated form, appreciation for all those created forms, three-leaf clovers, four-leaf clovers, etc. Seng San says there's nothing that we cannot know. So anything that we need to know can be known in that third kind of knowing. And the word for this third kind of knowing in Sanskrit is related to the word for liberation, for freedom. Can't find the line right now, but some four-leaf clovers are better left unpicked. Can we hear about the? Okay, I notice again that I'm sweating. Mm-hmm. Does that mean it's time?
What's the outside?
Also, could be. I can check. Might work. if we can feel the possibility that this third kind of knowing is something we may not have experienced, but can. If we can hear it and not get trapped in that debt, the feeling of not enoughness. And more the sense of possibility, where our being is leaning. And feeling for those times in our lives where we felt we really knew something or we really realized something. It can be also the most practical thing. It doesn't have to be a kind of tremendous spiritual revelation. The feeling of when you realized something or when you really knew something. Isn't it so that the head was the last to know about it? Kind of like a trickle-up effect, even if it's very quick. If we can go by that example, experiential knowing, and start more actively disbelieving all of our imagination. Also in the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, which I love, there is talk of several different ways that there is disturbance in the mind that stops us from being one with what we are. It stops us from knowing what we are. So yesterday we talked about how even a really true deep experience, even that, even correct seeing, stops us from taking our true shape, is how they actually talk about it, our own shape. And two of the ways that there's disturbance or movement in the mind that stops us from being ourselves are imagination, we could say imagination and delusion. For me today, it's not so important to differentiate them. I just want to talk about use the usual metaphor, snake and rope, to feel what that is, that there's disturbance in the mind that we kind of agree to, leaving our true form and taking on another shape, the shape of that disturbed mind. So it's not actually in this part of the sutras, it's not actually mentioned in this part, snake and rope, but it's such a common metaphor in India that we see a rope and we think it's a snake. And our experience, it's actually our experience that it's a snake, even though it's a rope. And I'd like to talk also about the opposite, which happens at least as often, where there's a snake and we take it to be a rope. There's something that is really venomous, and we take it as if it's a tool, something that could be helpful. And we don't step really, really carefully around or just get away as fast as possible. If we first of all accept that we don't have to be good enough. We don't have to be good enough. And we're not, also. In a way, we're not good enough for the immensity of the kind of revolution that can happen. So since we're not, luckily we don't have to be. And since we don't have to be, there's no escape. There's no reason to give up. This is a very good daily teaching, being a mother. I'm definitely not good enough to be a mother. And apparently I don't have to be, because I am. And there's no escape. And even when I leave behind my true form and take on all these different kind of monstrous shapes, it still doesn't take away the kind of basic, the basis. In this case, the connection, bond, love, the fact of care, the fact of human being. So if we don't have to be good enough, and whether we are or are not, and there's no escape, you can't just hire out on this job. Then is it more possible? We don't have to be good enough. Is it then more possible to feel the difference between imagination and experience? And is it possible to accept the quantity of actual, complete delusion that we live? Because we don't have to be good enough, and there's no escape. Can we accept how often we have completely projected on someone, and they're not at all, they're not that whatsoever. They don't hate us. They're not better than us. They're not worse than us. They're not even noisy, or whatever our thing is. And if we could specially turn that kind of willingness towards ourselves and the delusions we have about ourselves, we could accept that we do live by, in many cases, complete fabrications, complete untruths about ourselves, and we live by them. We stand by them. No, there is something wrong with me. You just haven't met me yet. Or I am really better than everyone else. They go together. Don't worry. You're not alone. So just a couple little examples to help get you going in your research about what's imagination, what's delusion, and what's experience. Sometimes there is an experience where there's just a simple meeting. You hear the rain, or you see the leaf, or whatever. And then you remember that, and you imagine that, and you have this, it's like a created form. You have this imagined form. You have this, you're just walking, and you actually, there's just a step that gets taken, or a breath that just happens. And then you have this, you can actually feel the created form of the next breath that hasn't happened yet, and it's completely fabricated. You can feel the expectation of how the step is going to feel when you haven't taken the step. So getting to know what that feels like, not as something wrong that puts you out of the game because you don't have to be good enough, but as something that's not an actual experience, it's not actually experiential. In a certain way. It's not direct experience. It's illusory experience, if you will. And with those small things, letting it pop rather than kind of turning on the bloodhound thing inside, going and trying to find it. With delusion, just playing with when you hear what is the inner atmosphere much of the time in yourself? Just playing with another perspective. You're worried about something in your life, and the perspective of, even if it's imagined for now, the end of your life, does that really matter? Or what if right now, not don't wait till you're about to die, right now in our experience we have this, but what if right now we are not limited to this, that actually there is something huge, that is equally us, if not more. We just don't perceive it. What if? That can help us catch when we have these delusional glasses on. When there's emotional charge, there's delusion. And probably imagination also. Doesn't mean we're wrong to be emotional, to feel emotions. But to be pushed around by, I just love this image of the emotions as the general of the army that comes from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. When we're so willing to be obedient to that general, we need to dig for our deeper honesty and have some relief from the emotional charge. It doesn't mean that you don't experience something or that something's not important. We can feel the importance with that kind of calmness that's not an extinguished fire much more clearly without the emotional charge. And we can then act and be acted upon in accordance with that. So there was someone on the last retreat who was worried about going home and had so appreciated being in silence, she thought she couldn't be, she'd never been silent before for like even an hour, and so 3 days was a miracle to her and she wanted to stay. And imagining going home with her busy family and all the cell phones ringing and trying to cook and all the mess, and it seemed impossible. And so she had some questions about her needs for silence or space or tidiness. And we talked a little bit about that, and that was good. There's a certain interpersonal level where it might be time to set some, like, okay, I'm going to cook dinner for all of you, and I need you to get out of here for now, for 1 hour. That could be said with love. But it was much more interesting when we left the language of my needs, her needs, and came back to what she really started from, which was what she felt, that she, when she felt her feet, it just resonated in her so much. When she had enough space to feel her feet, her whole being was resonating joyously. And that seemed like a much better, cleaner place to start from than my needs. So. Also, partly to play with the way that we project onto teachers and famous teachers, and it's partly our own parents and partly our wish for escape. But it just came to mind a few little little tiny, for me, jewels of my experience with a few different teachers. Some of them happen now to be well known. Because I started to realize that what really stands out for me in my contact with these teachers is not the amazing Dharma talks or the books or anything like that. It was when Sharon Salzberg, who now I don't know how many books she has, and I haven't seen her in like 25 years, and I still remember when she took the time to invite me, who was working in the office as a volunteer, for ice cream. And on the way, we talked about this guy, and she so rightly told me I shouldn't get back together with him, which I did. And that's really the only time we had a talk, really. And I just remember that she was right. She probably knew I wasn't going to listen to her too, but she did say it. And there's some kind of like really meeting me. Christopher Titmus, I've been on quite a few retreats with him, teaching as well as meditating as a participant. And I struggle to remember a single Dharma talk, except one that was just a really long, hilarious story. But even that fades now for me in comparison to two things that he said sometimes. He said more than once. Sometimes at the end of the day, which was a really long day on those retreats in Bodh Gaya, the extra long sitting ended at 10:20. in the night. And he would say, and you might just, I won't try to imitate his accent because I'm, I something in me almost started to do it without my agreement. He would say, you might just stand outside under the stars and with your tiny little eyes perceive something so vast and so far away. And it might be partly the contrast to this very British man who was teaching a lot of pretty dry, sometimes pretty dry at that time, Buddhist teachings, that he would say that. And the other thing that stays with me that he said a few times over the years, sometimes you might be meditating quietly and there's such a stillness that you wouldn't like to move your little finger. And that was sort of all he would say about that. And it was also enough. I think that's enough. Are there any questions or comments?
I have a question. Okay. You talked about the emotional, and I find it tricky. Something happened yesterday where I noticed that there were, you talked a lot about skin and in both metaphor and physically. And I know I have a trigger around skin, mm-hmm. and knowing that, and I didn't want to touch it, I didn't want to go into it, mm-hmm. and so I didn't. Mm-hmm. So I avoided the emotional, but I also didn't go far. Like there was a sense that today I realized, oh, I needed to go farther to touch something, mm-hmm. and just not go into the story mm-hmm. of it, you know, the, perfect. And so this is the challenge for me to touch it enough and let it pass through. I find mm-hmm. it a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good practice. And you don't have to be good enough. So sometimes the story will take over. And it's okay. And sometimes your inner knowing will be quick. Since you don't have to be good enough, it'll be quick and be like, not scared anymore. It is, even when story takes over, possible to not take it personally. So, and the emotional charge is about taking it personally. But when we hear that emotional charge is a signal of something's wrong, then we usually take that personally. And then we're like, oh my God, I feel emotional charge. I'm doing it wrong or whatever. So all of that is okay. It's normal. And it happens for reasons. It's got momentum going, and so that's why it takes practice. This is the part that is tameable. And even in that, like, recovering that untameable, the tenderness towards yourself of, like, we need to take care here. I know myself, and we need to take care here. We don't just dive into the skin. And I did say in the meditation, but it's so weird that I'll say it again, that with skin, it can be really amazing to go skin, superficial skin, deep skin, fat. And it's really interesting if we think of what fat is. It's an insulating layer. Mm-hmm. And you can really sometimes, if with practice, some people have that kind of ability to feel in the body that way. It doesn't have to be super precise, but just getting fat into the picture or leaving skin and coming to fat can give that this enough sense of protection, insulation. Okay, there can be a lightning storm going on, but there's insulation also. It's not going to come strike me to the core. And that then the intelligence of the skin that could know how to handle a lightning storm can start to come back because there's the rest of the system can feel more protected. And another cool counterpart to skin is marrow, like going as far inside as you can, going right inside the bones. there's a cool resonance between those two kinds of cells. So in a really weird practical way, it's something you could play with. And otherwise what you said sounds really wise. So maybe just with more confidence, knowing that sometimes the story's gonna take over and that doesn't take away your perfection either. And it's also really important that we don't go to that misunderstanding of practice where we think that really, really it's about getting my guts together and facing that difficult thing. It's more about having that experience of insulation when there hasn't been that, when there's shock running through the whole body, to have the actual experience of insulation or safety, care running through the system. And then whatever needs attention just naturally comes towards that. So we don't have to go looking for it. It will want to come when the atmosphere is loving enough. Things come by themselves. It doesn't mean it's easy when it comes, necessarily. But we're less likely to be doing damage in the name of doing our work or doing good. Anything else there?
Nothing now. Thank you.
Okay. So let's have a few moments quiet. Just moments, quietly sweating together. May we live in untamable knowing, not separate. From what is. May our willingness to care deeply be part of a momentum towards liberation for all.